Welcome, members and guests, to the January 15th program of the City Club of Eugene, governing for racial and cultural equity in health services. I'm James Baldock, City Club President. Our sponsors today are the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, PacInfo Internet Solutions, and Funk Levi's and Associates, Marketing and Public Relations. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space, and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights, and for archiving the podcast on their website. We'd also like to thank Community Television of Lane County for televising recent City Club programs Monday through Friday at noon, Saturday at 10:30 a.m., and Sunday at 9 p.m. We host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year, and today is our 16th program in our 2015-2016 programming year. If you believe that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's host is Lisa Arkin, who will be introducing the speakers.
Today's speakers bring deep expertise on health, equity, and government to this forward-looking discussion on the future of public health. In Oregon, some local governments are adopting policies and programs that support human rights, social justice, and racial equity at all levels. They find that taking a deeper look and identifying institutional and structural racism can help eliminate the root causes of health inequities. Our three speakers will share new approaches to achieve equity initiatives. Our first speaker is Ben Duncan. Ben is the Chief Officer and Director of the Office of Diversity and Equity for Multnomah County Health. Ben is also co-chair of Region 10 Health Equity Council through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Minority Health. Ben and I have often worked together through his role as chair of the Oregon Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force, and Ben is also a duck. He graduated from the U of O in Environmental Studies in 1999. I'll introduce everyone, and then Ben will be our first speaker. Our second speaker is Desiree Williams-Raji. She is currently the Equity Specialist for the City of Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. She has developed City of Portland's equity initiatives, including the creation of the Office of Equity and the integration of equity into Portland's 2015 Climate Action Plan, also for the Multnomah County Climate Action Plan. She has served in a variety of community leadership roles with organizations such as the Center for Diversity and the Environment and the Portland African American Leadership Forum. Our third speaker is Dr. Patrick Ludke. Dr. Ludke is the Senior Public Health and Medical Officer for Lane County Department of Health and Human Services, a position he has held since 2011. He earned his medical degree at the Medical College of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and his Master of Public Health at the University of Utah.
Good afternoon. I want to thank the City Club of Eugene for the honor of speaking, and Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics for coordinating the program today. As Lisa mentioned, it's exciting for me to be back here in Eugene where I did my undergraduate studies and was first exposed to the concepts of environmental justice, which is a theme that will continue throughout my remarks today. As a student, I was really interested in understanding the ways that environments interacted with humans and vice versa. We were in the midst at that time of policy debates about forest use. This was the time of old growth and spotted owl protections, which has had serious impacts on timber country, which is a conversation for another day. But I was starting to be exposed to data and the reality of environmental policies that were disproportionately impacting low-income people of color, that throughout the United States and even in the progressive spaces of Eugene or Portland, environmental harm was creating disparities in communities of color. And this interest led to a career in this work. So we have the opportunity today to discuss and acknowledge what the data clearly shows in health, and I'm not sure to who attribute the initial statement too, but it said that your zip code is a better predictor of your health than your genetic code. This means that place And the places that we create, where we live, work, play, and practice spirituality, are critical to health outcomes. So we must be able to commit to closing those gaps so that race does not predict how long you will live or the prevalence of disease. The World Health Organization has defined health as not simply the absence of disease or illness, but a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, meaning that we aren't simply talking about health outcomes at an individual level. We're talking about income, education. We're talking about housing affordability and transportation access. We're talking about working conditions, environmental exposure, violence, criminal justice, etc. So when we talk about health, we're talking about all of those things. And in each of these areas, we see the impacts of institutional and structural racism. So as someone working in the public sector, we're going to talk today about the role of government in addressing these inequities. We have to target strategies to focus on improvement on those who are suffering. We have to challenge ourselves to move beyond services and focus on changing policies, institutions, and structures. And I don't want to suggest that we haven't made progress. We've largely moved beyond policies that explicitly discriminate against a group. And we owe debts of gratitude as we stand here today celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King and others who fought to make that a reality. But we are still challenged by policies that impact groups unintentionally. We see this, for example, in drug arrests, where we know that the law is race neutral. But and drug usage between communities of color and white communities is around equal. But the arrests and sentencing and impacts on people of color are disproportionate. And of course, that we see that at an individual, that individual racism and unconscious bias show up throughout our institutions and interactions with communities. And these interactions have cumulative impacts. And we're learning more and more in public health that the impacts of chronic stress from the experience of racism is impacting people's health. There's a tangible impact to the experience of racism. So what does this mean? In our public institutions, we must acknowledge the historical legacy that government has contributed to creating inequities. We have to own our own collective institutional racism as governments, but also as cities and as states. Like my friend and colleague, Walida Emerisha, has done a lot of work, and many of you have followed and tracked these stories. You know, Oregon in and of itself was formed as a white utopia, right? That we stand here in our origin story as that of white supremacy. There's a legacy that that's created. We have to own that. And I'll talk briefly about some of the ways that governments, reflecting on a couple of the spaces that I operate in, are working to develop approaches to solve these persistent and deep disparities in our racial and ethnic communities. And let me preface by saying, you know, we need to move beyond the individual to the institutional and to the structural. And I'll talk about four areas which I believe this can happen. The first is funding targeted and culturally specific services to help those with the greatest need. What Professor John Powell out of the Haas Center at Berkeley describes as targeted universalism, an approach that supports the needs of the particular while reminding us we are all part of the same social fabric. We set universal goals, but our strategies are focused. The second is to focus on policy change and integrate racial equity analysis into our decision-making and our planning. And I'll come back to that in a moment more specifically. And third, partnering with communities most impacted by disparities and supporting and building capacity in these communities to create solutions. Finally, government can work across jurisdictions to build a national movement within government that continues to challenge ourselves and each other to advance this work. So there's examples of each of these that I could dive deeper into, but today I'd like to focus on tools that governments can use to address equity. Tools that proactively seek to eliminate inequities and advance equity by identifying clear goals, objectives, and outcomes that calls for actionable and transparent data, that integrate racial equity into decision-making and is based on research and concepts that are grounded in communities of color, that engages and integrates feedback from those communities who are most impacted. So in Multnomah County, the tool we developed is called the Equity and Empowerment Lens, which is a framework consisting of a set of questions that focus on the impacts in the areas of people, place, process, and power. And it's accompanied by other tools that support practitioners and aligns the guiding values of empowerment, cultural responsivity, trauma-informed approaches, restorative intent, all with quality improvement. That this is about government improving the quality of the services that we deliver and improving the quality of the decisions that we make. This work is rooted in social movements and reflective of what communities, for as long as they've been advocating and challenging us for better outcomes, have asked for. So in a very simple way of describing something that's a much more sophisticated analysis, it asks us to understand who is impacted and how. And how do we engage those who are most impacted in decisions that affect their lives? How does our geography and spatial considerations show up both in our in how communities are impacted, but also in our investments? And how and who is making decisions? And how are we working to share power and build power in communities that are most impacted? There's an adage in environmental justice that says, communities that speak for themselves best protect themselves. So we can work towards ensuring that government is both developing internal ways to improve how our investments and decisions impact communities that have been most vulnerable and impacted, and work to build power in those same communities, develop their own strategies. I'm going to end by reflecting a bit on Dr. Martin Luther King. And as I was preparing remarks for today, I was revisiting the last weeks of King's life. Dr. King's work shaped today's struggle for environmental justice. And in fact, the last work he ever did was focused on improving the lives of African-American sanitation workers in Memphis. Workers who remind us of many workers today, doing work that is seen as inferior, exposed to hazardous conditions, unable to or threatened to organize, working for low wages that leave entire communities in crushing poverty. Dr. King's organizing was focused on a poor people's campaign for distributive justice, how we distribute the benefits and the burdens of our society. And in one of his last speeches, he summed up the plight for those who for too long had been the victims of injustice. He said, "We are tired of being at the bottom. We are tired of being trampled over by the iron feet of oppression. We are tired of having to live in dilapidated, substandard housing conditions where we don't have wall-to-wall carpets, but so often we end up with wall-to-wall rats and roaches. We are tired of working our hands off and laboring every day and not even making a wage adequate to get the basic necessities of life. We are tired." And as I reflect on this, and as I hope we're all reflecting on that, as much progress as we have made, this sentiment still rings true for so many of our communities of color. The struggle continues. So I look forward to continuing this conversation as we move into question and answer and more dialogue. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you to the Eugene City Club and Lisa Arkin for inviting me to be here today with you and be a part of this wonderful panel in honor and in tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What I'd like to talk to you all about today is the concept of institutional change, complementary to many of the things that Ben has already presented to you all today. We see change happen at the confluence of something painful meeting something hopeful. We see this true even at the individual level. It's what helps us overcome things like addictions to smoking and alcohol. During the civil rights movement, this pain was a chronic disease. It was a disease that had progressed to a systems failure. This disease was and is the social injustice of racism, an insidious form of hatred designed to justify our nation's use of slavery and continuing human oppression for economic development. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. brought us words of hope, a vision for a different future, and then a vision that was so compelling it led people to action. It led people to create laws and new institutions to organize themselves in different ways. From this, we learn that institutional change requires three things: a compelling reason to change, a vision for a new and different future that is better than what we see today, and lastly, a path to move that vision forward. And here we are today at the beginning of the year 2016. We're in a place of reawakening. There's one other important tool for change, and that's evaluation. We have to ask ourselves, what have we accomplished in the past 40 years? Well, we've accomplished a lot. A black man has held 2 terms in the presidential office. We see people of color continuing to pursue their dreams and achieve beyond what our grandparents thought was ever possible in media, in business, and as leaders of social change. I know Ben and I stand here today, and it would not have been possible without the struggle of those who came before us. There's no doubt that progress has been made, but we must look at the totality of our current situation. Equity demands that we assess progress based on the prosperity achieved by those with the least. And from this standpoint, we know that with our success have come failures. That failure continues to deepen. Black Lives Matter has become a visual and visceral reminder to our nation that racism, racial bias, segregation, they're all still very real and still very entrenched into the systems that determine our livelihoods and, in truth, whether we live or die. These systems are the justice system, our schools, all levels of government, health institutions, and financial institutions. In order to effect real change, we have to build our capacity beyond just changing the hearts and minds of individuals, but changing the hearts and minds of institutions. So I'd like to bring this back to the example of the city of Portland. In 2009, we worked on a strategic plan for the city, which we call the Portland Plan. In 2009, we also had 2 really critical reports that were published, one by Multnomah County, the Coalition of Communities of Color. It was called An Unsettling Profile, and the second was The State of Black Oregon. Both those reports showed us that the experience of communities of color was worse off than their white counterparts, and that goes across all indicators: health, education, economic opportunity, and overrepresentation in the prison system. And in addition to that, it was not only just worse in 2009, it was worse in 2009 than it was 30 years prior. So what does that say? 30 years of investment, of action, of investment in anti-poverty campaigns and Head Start programs to actually correct the injustices that were being fought for in the civil rights movement. So 30 years later, these communities are worse off. Okay, well, that's a problem. So what do we have to do about that? So this is something we have to hold on to. The other component of this that we had to also figure out is the demographic change that's happening in the city. So we did some projections, and we're on par with the rest of the nation. 25 years in the future, we will have a majority people of color in our city. So this means 30 years of failed action, communities of color who are not faring well. We move that forward into that trajectory, that 25-year trajectory. If we continue this path, we're going to be in a pretty bad place. So we have to do something. We have to do something. So what is that? Well, we realize that poverty, poor health outcomes, low graduation rates, and having large numbers of our population in prison is an opportunity cost. We are not maximizing or harnessing the potential of our community. We are allowing it to be simply wasted away. This loss of human potential is everyone's problem. The opportunity cost is one that we cannot afford as a community. Because of this, the city of Portland established an equity framework. And what that means is that in the strategic plan, we have all these different things, an economic plan, an education plan, community prosperity plan. But this equity framework is the filter by which all of those things will be accomplished. And that equity framework prioritizes race. So how are we going to actually implement a racial equity framework? Well, we realize what we have to do first is get used to the word racism. Racism is a scary word. It's that R word that just makes people kind of cringe and get uncomfortable. And there's a really good reason for that. There's a lot of pain, a lot of guilt, a lot of history associated with that word. But what we realize is if we're not talking about racism, then we're not actually addressing the root cause of the problem. And so much of that work, that 30 years of work, wasn't addressing racism. It was addressing everything but racism. And so we could not expect anything but there to be outcomes that showed disparity across race. So for much of our history, we also have been doing a lot of this work at an individual level, talking about individual racism, people's beliefs, individual beliefs and perceptions. This is really important work, and it needs to continue. But the work that I'm doing and the work that Ben is doing is on institutional racism and bias. This is how the systems actually operate. The policies, the programs, the procedures, the services that we provide for the public, how do they operate? And what is it about them that are actually producing these disparate outcomes? Well, understanding institutional racism, in my mind, is a professional competency. If you're to study management or administration of any kind, it only makes sense to understand the history and context of the institutions we work within and their impact on the communities served. So we have to know that this country was actually founded on very racist principles, and this is something that we have inherited. This is not something that was created in the civil rights movement. This was created many, many years ago, and the policies and the things that we implement today are built on that foundation. If we are not able to see that, if we do not understand that, how can we therefore fix it? The study of institutional racism gives you a language and analysis to understand how power, privilege, and bias operate in our society. And for us in the city of Portland, it is helping us to understand how we can make those decisions differently in a way that doesn't produce those disparate outcomes. But I wanted to be transparent that we are very nascent in this work. We're 300 years in the making of these institutions. In the last 6 years, 7 years, you know, we have to be a little bit modest and humble in what we can expect in terms of change. But still, I'm very optimistic. Our primary accomplishment has been in committing to this analysis through policies and developing competencies. It's too early to show that the work has resulted in different outcomes, to be sure. Our successes thus far have been in taking this analysis and asking very difficult questions about the power we have as decision makers and institutions, using tools like the Climate Action Plan, which sets a 25-year action plan for how we would invest and build differently as a city so that we can be carbon neutral. But what does that mean if we say that everyone has to be a part of the solution and that we're not allowing poor people and people of color to have and take the burden of the cost of that carbon neutral society? We have to think differently. We have to think creatively about how we approach the future. We're also using the comprehensive plan. Gentrification is a huge issue in the city of Portland. How we make land use decisions impacts people's economic opportunity. We have to think creatively about the way that we create policies so that we can mitigate, minimize, and correct for those impacts to those communities. So we're changing our processes to be more inclusive, similar to the tools that Ben had mentioned. We've made commitments and goals that outline better outcomes for communities. But time will be the true test to the staying power of this work. So I too wanted to leave you with a final thought and a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. All mankind is tied together. All life is interrelated. And we are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. And you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. And this is the justification in my mind that we should all be in a tireless pursuit of equity. To continue our pursuit toward lasting change at the individual, institutional, and societal level. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Thanks to City Club for inviting me back. I've been in this room several times. I must say, every time I come here, I'm excited to come here, and I'm also a little nervous because I know I'm going to be challenged here. I know I'm going to be made uncomfortable, but usually in a comfortable way. I suspect the question and answer session will be the same as other times here. My role here today is a bit different than the first two speakers. I was asked to address three main areas where public health, which is 50% of my job, and our community health center clinics, which is the other 50% of my job, have looked at equity or used an equity lens to impact the health of citizens. And the three questions, and I will just read them. How past health and local government systems have failed to provide equity for all residents? What programs are now being put in place to address past inequities, biases, and failures? And what are each of the divisions within the organization doing to ensure parity, justice, and to help government employees gain the skills necessary to carry out equity in programming and services? So to do that, I'm going to start with the World Health Organization, a different definition than Ben used. The World Health Organization's definition of equity, which is really simple and straightforward and helps guide my thoughts. According to WHO, equity is the absence of avoidable or remediable differences among people, among groups of people. So, pretty simple definition. And of course, one might ask themselves, what does that mean, the differences? And that's broken down several different ways. It's broken down economically, demographically, geographically, socially. And keep that lens in mind as I talk about what we're doing at the Health and Human Services Program in Lane County. And I want to first begin with our community health centers of Lane County. And apologies to the listeners on the radio, but I'm going to ask people to raise their hand. Who has not heard of the community health centers of Lane County? So to the listeners on the radio, there were probably 5 out of maybe 100 people in the room who had not heard of it, and that's a good thing. Community health centers are federally qualified health centers, and they are meant to address health care needs of the underserved, uninsured population. And when I took this job 4.5 years ago, we had 2. We now have 6. We've expanded markedly. And we're not alone in that. There's now about 9,000 of them in the United States, pretty impressive numbers, and which is the largest primary care provider of services in the country, larger than the military, the VA, larger than Kaiser, larger than Group Health. It's a huge organization. And some unique areas to address these three questions that City Club wanted me to address around how it is we are looking at the needs of this population through equity. I have 5 in particular. The first is we focus on persons who need care the most, and we have no inability to pay requirement. So we serve anyone who can come in regardless of their ability to pay. We have a sliding scale that allows patients to be seen and pay based upon what they're able to pay. Persons are eligible for care typically based on the federal poverty level. I think many in this audience are familiar with that. But when we look at those 4 main areas of how it is that the WHO has divided up equity, social, eco, demographic, and geographic, we also realize that there are unique ways to reach subpopulations, these populations who have potentially remediable differences. For example, cognitive issues. How is it that we in a community health center clinic can address not only their physical health issues like high blood pressure, but also perhaps cognitive and behavioral challenges? One of the ways that we are doing that, and many across the country now are, is integrating behavioral health with primary care. I'm happy to say that of my 6 clinics, 4 of them have behaviorists in the clinics working hand-in-hand with the primary care providers. That's new and unique. When I was a primary care doc 25 years ago, I would have loved to have had a behaviorist in my clinic to take care of the anxiety or take care of the major depressive episode that I could not reach very well as an internal medicine provider. Another item that we're doing is we actually understand the need to reach people in the language and the culture that they are most familiar and comfortable with. And the county has a protocol, and probably a surprise to no one here, that we actually give an incentive payment to people who are proficient in a certain language, a certain culture. Typically, it's a 5% bump in pay, for example, if you speak Spanish. And we recruit people in that regard. Some time ago, we didn't do that. That's a new program. Also, at the community health center clinics, we realized that in the olden days, we'd build these beautiful clinics, and we'd expect people to come to us. That's not really equity. We have to find a way to go to them to reach those people. So we have voucher systems to pay for cab fare and ride source and a variety of other systems to get people where they need to go. They're not perfect. There probably are a few of you in the audience who know many of the major challenges in our rural communities, getting people into healthcare and behavioral health and dental. But we have those programs in place. We also have begun looking through new lenses of adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, and trauma-informed care. These are new programs that we have never done before in primary care. We didn't have an evidence base really to use these to reach certain needs in this patient population. So I think that I've spoken mostly so far with the community health centers about what we're doing. If you flip that coin over, you can see what we didn't do. That's what we didn't do in the past. We didn't reach people where they needed to be reached. We didn't provide them opportunities to come see us in terms of transportation or getting them to their the laboratory to have their blood drawn or getting to x-ray to have their imaging done. We are now doing that much more commonly. On the community side, who here has not heard of the Community Health Assessment or Community Health Improvement Plan? Raise your hand, please. So quite a few, roughly half of the room has not heard of it. So we in public health are actively trying to empower communities to understand their needs around health, their needs around the broader definition of health that Ben mentioned earlier. And we have gone out to large numbers of organizations, schools and churches and businesses, et cetera, to go through a process of assessing their needs and what they view as the real health challenges in the community. We had our community health assessment and our first community health improvement plan created for Lane County. It was a joint project of four organizations in the community, the United Way, Trillium Community Health Plan, Peace Health Hospital Group, and Public Health. And the four of us came together and assessed these groups throughout the county to understand what needed to be done to improve health, improve equity. We're now working on version 2.0. We expect it will be out in draft form by about April of this year, and invite you all to go to that. It'll be a public event. But anyway, the key point about the Community Health Assessment, Community Health Improvement Plan, is to go out and hear from the community just what it is that they feel are the key issues to help improve their life. And we had, again, not done that before. Now, there's been a coalescence of reasons why this has happened. First of all, the evidence base has grown significantly in public health to understand that this is the way we should go. Secondly, the Affordable Care Act has changed the rules around it and has the ability to reimburse organizations or fine them if they're a nonprofit healthcare organization and they don't do a CHA or a CHIP, Community Health Assessment or Community Health Improvement Plan. And third, the coming together of these various entities, mental health, dental health, physical health, substance abuse treatment, the evidence has come together to the point where we realize this is the right way to go. Also in the public health arena, and I'm going to speak of some specifics here, we have in Lane County Public Health, we have an equity program. We have requirements of all of our employees to have a certain number of hours of equity training, social justice training each year, and we have to actually put it on our time card, so we are assessed to make sure that we do that. That is, again, relatively new. We also are looking at other ways to hire the workforce that is needed internally in both public health and in our clinics to address the cultural needs, to address the variety of needs that are not being met. And as a physician and as a medical epidemiologist, I can tell you, when I was stationed overseas as a Navy doc in the early 90s when the internet came about, and I was really surprised to see the number of people who went to get their healthcare on the internet in the mid-90s. And after a couple years of realizing that I really can't compete with the electron, it's going to be faster than I am forever, I realized that probably the biggest reason people are choosing to do this is we're not meeting their needs. We in the clinical community, whether we say just primary care or the broader clinical community, including behaviorists, et cetera, we're not meeting the needs of our community. And consequently, they're finding a way to meet their needs, and we need to address that issue. So finally, I want to talk about behavioral health in particular. Within Lane County government, we have the county mental health program. We also have a payer for behavioral health services. It's co-located with Trillium, the community health plan. It's called Trillium Behavioral Health. And a variety of initiatives in that arena are worth mentioning to address the three questions that City Club wanted me to address. First is, we have a rural advisory council to address the rural needs for behavioral health needing persons. Again, 5 years ago, when I first moved here, we did not have that. This is an active committee. They meet every month. They meet in various places throughout the county. They have a system to get people there and to fund their travel should they need that. And it is a voice, an opportunity for a voice for this rural community to talk to the system to allow it to work in their best interest. We also have a coastal health network working on behavioral health and primary care. And again, our coastal health area is also fairly rural, and there's a lot of needs in the Reedsport area, which is outside of our county, but part of our draw area for healthcare, and in Florence, et cetera. We have, in addition, a big initiative as a graying population in the United States. We have elderly persons with a lot of behavioral health needs that are clearly not being met. And we have an ongoing system-building opportunity through Trillium Behavioral Health and through the County Mental Health Program to address the behavioral health needs of persons who are elderly. And again, this is something new, and we're being driven that way partly because our population is graying. Finally, there's a variety of training opportunities and training initiatives that we're pushing, some through the county health programs, public health and the community health centers, and some through our Trillium Community Health Plan and what we call Trillium University, which is a variety of trainings for providers and healthcare personnel. One of them I'll mention is a new one on gender reassignment surgery. This is an initiative within the state of Oregon, and we are doing the best that we can to try to train up the community to understand the needs of this and how it is we can address the needs of that particular population. So I'm going to stop there and just finish again as we go to the question and answer session with this WHO definition of equity. Again, the absence of avoidable or remediable differences among groups of people. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on this today.
Thank you. Today's topic is governing for racial and cultural equity in health services. Our speakers are Ben Duncan, Desiree Williams-Rajee, and Dr. Patrick Ludke. We'll break now for a few minutes and then return with members' questions.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene, 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
Thank you to the City Club, to Lisa, and to each of you for speaking to us today, for all of the work that you're doing in the world, which is incredibly important, and also for bringing this conversation about institutional racism here to our community in Eugene and the idea of institutionalized environmental health inequalities. I teach environmental justice at the University of Oregon every year, and when I do this, we spend some time talking about the institutional problems here in this community, the fact that 99% of toxic emissions are in within Eugene are into the poorest part of town, the area of town with the most people of color. We talk about how proposed expansions would site more factories in these kinds of in this community. We talk about how childhood asthma in Bethel is twice what it is in the rest of Eugene. And we learn that often when families arrive here, immigrant families from farther south, that actually their health quality conditions can go down, increasing in different diet-related diseases and things. We also spend a lot of time talking about the idea that it is not because, or not only, and not primarily because of individual malice that this is happening, or sort of overt prejudice, but that these are, in fact, very institutionalized kinds of situations. And given that this has been so wonderfully emphasized here, given to try to build momentum on the work that you each are doing and the talk that you've given in this community, I wonder if possible, I want to give a couple of ways you might take this, if you could talk about, on the one hand, what are the challenges and opportunities that each of you have seen in your position in government in trying to address and talk about institutionalized racism, which can be very sort of alienating, or perhaps make the public feel what can I do? Secondly, if you have particular ideas or angles in terms of how we may in this community challenge the institutional production of these health inequalities, in addition to the wonderful ways that institutions can respond to these health inequalities. And finally, sort of in relation to the public peace, you know, was mentioned that this is a very a state that has been founded on this idea of a white utopia. I myself am white. It's very easy for me to sort of arrange my life such that I never have to think hard about these kinds of things. And yet, how can the public be involved, and how should the public be involved in addressing these? So there's a couple of options for you. Long question. Thank you.
Wow. Was that really just one question? So I will make maybe one opening thought that might take us down a road we don't want to go there, or maybe we'll stop and get on a different road quickly. But one of the areas where we have significant institutionalized problems is in the way that we pay for healthcare. So we really clearly need what is jargonly being called alternative payment methodologies, APM. How is it we change the way that we can pay for what's really needed to improve the health and well-being of people? And it's our former governor, Governor Kitzhaber, talked about why is it that if somebody really needs an air conditioner to prevent them from getting congestive heart failure in the hot August weather of Oregon, why can't the healthcare system pay for that as opposed to just paying for more heart medication? That's the kind of change that we need. And if we're talking about institutionalized challenges, one of them is clearly just that. And I firmly believe that we will spend $3 trillion on healthcare in this country this year. We really don't need any more money in healthcare. We need to put it in different places. And one of the institutionalized challenges is just that, the way that the system allows us to use those funds.
I need to write something real quick.
Sure, that was a real... just dodged that, right?
Yeah.
I appreciate the question. I mean, I think there's... And it's a lot to sort through. I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is that in spaces like Portland or Eugene, when we see the political environments that we're in, that it becomes even more egregious when we see these type of disparities. You know, I had the wonderful opportunity with Beyond Toxics maybe a year ago, maybe a little longer, to go on a toxics tour of this community, right? So when you go into the Train Song neighborhoods in West Eugene, it becomes really egregious. You know, as someone who spent years here, this is an incredible place to live, right? And the same with Portland, right? You know, the New York Times writes every week about how Portland's the most wonderful place to live and everybody's riding bikes and eating organic food and all this. It makes it more egregious when you juxtapose that with the experience of people of color, right? And Desiree talked about what the data says. Now, I think some of the challenges is in part how we talk about it, and Desiree alluded to this, that part of it is we need to name it, right? We need to name race, we need to name racism, we need to own the contributions that all of us have made to creating the conditions that lead to these disparities. And we need to shift the concept. You know, in environmental justice, you know, I think often people will argue, especially when we're talking about land use and development, well, that's the market drives that, right? That the market, you know, that's where land is cheaper, so that's where industry goes, and that's where land is cheaper, so that's why we build affordable housing right at a fence line next to these toxic spaces, right? And it becomes these false narratives, right? And I think we have to, when we think about the role of government, not just having courage to name these things, but having a commitment to undoing that harm. And I would be remiss if I didn't also suggest that when I look at this room, and I don't know most of you, but I think about the work Beyond Toxics is doing, when I think about, you know, environmental justice as a movement, that this work is not just government's obligation, but it's community's obligation, right? How do you support and build capacity in those communities most impacted to push up against decision making? But if we don't acknowledge that land use decisions, for example, impact people's lives, and we don't hold folks who are part of that decision-making accountable for the outcomes that we're seeing, then we're going to perpetuate the same things we've been seeing over and over and over again. So I realize it's a complicated question. I think if we had it in writing, maybe we could build off it, but I'll stop.
I did try to write it down. Let's see. I wanted to write a few things down because I want to get more specific about what I think is the mindset. And I think what the main barrier that we have is one of a thinking, where people's sort of analysis comes from. And it comes from your experience. It comes from how you grew up. It comes from the things that you've been exposed to in your life. And so in our society, we have a dominant white culture, and our institutions have been built upon that being a norm. And so if you identify with that culture, you operate within institutions designed for you to succeed. And so it's important to understand how that design works in order to be able to change it and make it more expansive so that others can experience prosperity as well. And there are some things, though, that we also have to look at and look for that we need to change in order for it to be more inclusive and expansive. And so there are some things that I talk about in terms of sort of rules of how these things work. And so the first one is scarcity. That oftentimes what we do is we consider scarce resources. We don't have enough money to fund something. In truth, we have billions of dollars, but we haven't figured out how to distribute those dollars so that we can have equitable outcomes. What we do is we distribute those dollars in the way that we've always distributed those dollars, and then we say, hey, we've got $100,000 in change from this $50 billion. How can we have use that to benefit the poor people? So that's a lack of creativity. I'm sorry, but we have to start with the billions of dollars and figure out at that point, how do we redistribute? And the other is collective versus individual. So oftentimes what we're looking at is just the individual experience versus a community well-being. And so am I okay? Well, that's important, but if we look at community well-being, and so when we're looking at plans, we have to actually not say, okay, are you as an individual okay, but what are we doing to put things into a community? Are we putting healthcare centers? Are we putting schools? Are we putting churches? Are we putting all the things that actually make a community vibrant so that it can feed back to that individual's well-being, rather than saying, oh, we put affordable housing way out there, and they're by themselves. Shouldn't that be enough because they can afford to live there? That's not a community. So community is something that we have to prioritize. Another is this thinking around it has to be this or it has to be that. We're either going to fund education or we're going to fund housing. Why is it always this one or the other? It has to be all. And we have to, again, use our creativity, our imaginations to think about how we're going to benefit everyone in a holistic way. We can't put one thing against the other. They're all necessary. And the last is competition versus collaboration. I actually am a very competitive person, so I believe in competition, but I think it's competition for a healthy outcome. And collaboration means that we're putting all of our assets, all of our resources together so that we can have the best and most maximized benefit of those resources. We're not competing against one another. City of Portland is not competing against Eugene, right? We have to look and see what are we creatively thinking about, how are we doing things differently, and put those types of solutions together for more collaborative and new innovative solutions. So it's those types of things, I think, thinking about how the system operates and pits us against each other, that has been our failure, so we have to counteract that.
Now we'll break for members' questions. Members, I just wanted to welcome back to the January 15th City Club program governing racial and cultural equity in health services. Our guest speakers are Ben Duncan, Desiree Williams-Rajee, and Dr. Patrick Lugke. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. My question would be to Dr. Lugke. Do we know how many people we have working for the county that qualify for food stamps? We are working on this information for the city right now. What I'm talking about is hiring people that are in poverty are the real problems. And we're talking about the bottom end of the inequity that we have, not the high wages, the bottom. Do we have that information in the county?
It's a simple question. I do not know the answer. I apologize. It is knowable, however, because our salaries are public knowledge. I wish I knew that.
So far, it's been withheld. John Radke from the SNAP program could tell you in 10 seconds, but for 3 years, he hasn't told me. Jerry Smith, City Club member since 2003. What can the public do when regulators allow Seneca's biomass burning to poison and sicken Eugene's low-income community?
Well, thank you for asking that question, too, and I think it relates to the earlier question on what can the public do to address the inequities that they see. And I have to say that none of the progress that we've made in the city of Portland has not been without incredible advocacy from the communities within the city of Portland.
coalitions and allies of groups who have brought forward these issues, have brought forward the data, have brought forward the information that we needed to make the right decisions. And, you know, I think what you're bringing up an example where it's a private corporation, and as government, we actually are in the business of public service. And so there was, what we could say is that, you know, you actually aren't doing your job well, because you said you're supposed to serve the public, and only some are being served and some are not. And we have a case to make around that. I think that, you know, putting the data forward, knowing who your allies are, and in this instance, I would also look back to government and regulation as to what is the role of government in a situation to actually serve the community and do the job that they were designed to do in order to protect everyone. And so while advocacy can go in various places, I know how effective the advocacy had been towards us as a public institution.
Sandy Erickson, City Club member. In the late 70s and early 80s, the United States discontinued the instruction of home economics. That is, what happens in the four walls? This was a huge national error, and rather than include men in that body of instruction, they eliminated it for everybody. So now, that lack of knowledge fails to even the playing field, and it especially affects lower-income people. And now we have government programs and nonprofits that must pick up the slack. So my question is, what are you going to do about it?
So I would begin with an acknowledgement that it is a problem and that with a solution that I'm not certain of. I will say that when I see patients, I have a variety of patients that pop into my mind thinking about your question. And I broaden that thought around not just home economics, but health literacy. Why is it that we as a population are increasingly drawn to these quick fixes for obesity, quick fixes, herbal supplements for this or that or this or that without data behind it? And how is it that we got to a point where that is the solution for many people, whether they have a wallet that's full or a purse that's empty? What are we going to do about it? The CHA and the CHIP that I discussed earlier is something to help empower communities, to help us understand better what their needs are, and also to help us move forward with supported programs. I would like to broaden your question a little bit further as well and talk about another area where I feel we've failed quite a bit. When I was a kid, I would hazard to guess that probably almost every school in this country had a school nurse. That is not the case anymore. And you could put up a variety of charts of health indicators showing that our immunization rates have dropped as we got rid of school nurses. Our childhood behavioral health metrics have dropped significantly. And we need infrastructure changes. And again, I would say we have almost $10,000 per person for healthcare in this country per year. That's that almost $3.2 trillion we'll spend. We need to move the money around in a more effective way.
Because I think there's a lot of work that's happening, not just in public health, but in communities, owning and teaching folks how to cook culturally specific foods, reconnecting people to the land, fighting and advocating for community gardens, you know, addressing policy that looks at the existence of food deserts. So I don't know if it gets to the premise of your question, but I think communities are starting to own, and I think public health is starting to own, how do we recreate the conditions so people can be healthy in their home environment.
Jane Smith, City Club member. I heard the word churches mentioned once. During the winter season, churches, upwards of 24, are very active in feeding and housing homeless persons, both families and individuals. The churches, for the most part, Protestant anyway, are all white. And so there's a big cultural divide, unintentional. What can you offer churches as a way to really connect with communities of color in ways that where there's a real payoff?
So what I would advise is similar to what we do in government, which is build relationships with various communities. You know, cultural communities are highly spiritual communities, and the type of religion that might be experienced in, or might be practiced in that community can range greatly. The asset that churches have are physical space, and communities oftentimes are in need of physical space to come together in community and to practice their spirituality. And in the city of Portland and actually in Washington County as well, you see many instances where churches are actually subletting or allowing their space to be used by multiple different denominations or different communities in order to share the asset that they have with others. And so whether it be doing that or actually, again, in allyship, helping other communities to see how they can create those spaces for themselves. So that would be one action that I could submit.
Randy Prince, City Club member. There's a lot of diversity among the communities of color. Immigrant, recent immigrants, longtime immigrants, some cases natives, income level, and the nuclear family, strong nuclear family or very fragmented family structures. I was wondering about the family in the communities of color. How much is that an asset or help in making sure that there is well-being and health, mentally, physically, behavioral health? You'd think that in most cases it's an asset to work with. In a few cases, maybe there's an authoritarian structure or too much tradition that doesn't transfer well. How much is that strength or weakness of the nuclear family something you consider when delivering health care to communities of color?
I'm a public health person. I don't know the answer. I mean, I think there's, to your maybe the initial place where you started, that if we think about communities of color as this kind of homogenous group, right? I mean, I think the answer is different for every family, right? I think that a strong kind of traditional family could have incredible benefits, but we also know, I think, plenty about how families are made up, and I think if we reflected on our own family, we might see the differences of positivity and reinforcing positive behavior and reinforcing negative behaviors. But I don't know if I have an answer, and I don't know if our public health folks are approaching kind of the stability of families as an important way to address health outcomes.
I would only add or maybe reiterate what Ben said, that each family is different, and very clearly there are families that have a single parent that have successful outcomes with their children, and there are others where it is a daily challenge to do anything, ranging from get to school, much less study and get good grades. So there's a variety infrastructures supporting them. What we can do from a system standpoint is, first of all, public health has three core functions. The first is assessment, the second is policy development, the third is assurance. We need to assess better who is in need. And that is a big part of our initiatives on community health assessment, community health improvement, as I've mentioned several times. And we are moving in that direction to assess better what those needs are. Then we need better levers on policy development with the business community, with our elected officials, et cetera. And then finally, that assurance side is we need to have the systems that allow us to get enough data to move forward with an evidence base, as opposed to we think this is the right thing to do. So I believe we're moving in a direction in that way in the last 3 to 5 years here, but there's a long way to go.
Thank you, Ben Duncan, Desiree Williams-Raji, and Dr. Patrick Lugke for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program, Governing for Racial and Cultural Equity in Health Services. Let's give a round of applause for a great program. And thanks again to our sponsors, the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County, PacInfo Internet Solutions, and Funk Levies and Associates, Marketing and Public Relations. A special thank you to the Eugene Area of Commerce for contributing its conference room for the first session of Lane County's Economy and Employment course, which City Club offers for teachers in collaboration with the Lane ESD and Lane Workforce Partnership, now located in the Chambers Building. Additionally, a special thank you to the Johnson's Crushers International for hosting a session of this course. We meet again on January 22nd at the Downtown Athletic Club for a report from D.C. with Congressman Peter DeFazio. Lunches for this program can be ordered on the City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thank you.